Again, my name is Laura, and I teach at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I am just on such a high being here at Holden, and I have, this is a standalone session, and what my hope had been is it was a three-part seminar, and it really has drawn upon my own teaching. I taught a course, and in my personal life, I've had a real interest in people that have been able to sustain a life of commitment for positive social change. And so I have done it in the college setting, but most importantly, I have found it for my own self as I have been grappling over the last few years of what I have seen as setbacks and feeling like, oh my goodness, where do I fit in terms of trying to sustain what I care about in light of forces that feel beyond what I can have a positive impact on. I'm a child of the Cold War. I grew up during the Cold War age. At the same time, it was a remarkable period where there were tremendous leaders, extraordinary individuals, so much going on that I felt I could sort of identify and work on different issues and learn from. So my hope in doing this session is that coming to Holden Village, I see this as a model of a microcosm of groups of people and loosely fit community that have, in various ways, been living a life of commitment alongside profound commitment to positive social change. So what I wanted to do, we will all introduce ourselves, and it's fun for me just to get a sense, because we've had kind of a different group. Some have already been here before. So the idea is we just want to know why you're here today, what do you care about, is there a specific issue that you're wanting to engage in, and just say your name. So would you mind saying?
Corky Searles, and I guess I was intrigued by the topic of dealing with adversity and people who are able to persevere through extreme situations and still come out as reasonable human beings.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Corky.
I'm Nancy Sorrells, and I'm just worried about the world. And I thought you might have some sparks for that, you know, to have you keep going.
Yeah.
I'm Jackie Ash. I'm sorry I'm so close to the beginning. I'm worried about the whole world, but I also am dealing with four losses in my family in the last 10 years, and I'm major. My sister, and I also, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I also mumble. I also have advanced Parkinson's, which I'm dealing with. I just tried the card.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Larson Powers. I think I'm concerned about how our children are going to take over the world. The values we're imparting.
Mm-hmm. Yvonne Mitchell. I was really intrigued by the topic, and I have pretty much my whole adult life been involved in one thing or another, and I just don't think we can ever stop learning from each other.
Thank you.
My name is Deb Clems. I also was the topic itself and help other people deal with it. I think I'm here more to listen than contribute. See how that goes. But if there's something I could learn to help my children when their time comes along, they face issues.
Thank you.
George Franz. I'm similar concern about the state of the world, the country, and looking to see, you know, what I can do to move forward. So, hoping to get ideas.
I'm Marion Frericks. I think that the last 2 years I've just been so depressed and tired that I'm watching TV and listening to news, that I was looking for some other people maybe you knew how to react better to or sustain.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Sorry, do you want to see you?
Anyway, so it was a question of just listening to how others are dealing with that. And I think is, you know, everything I care about is being undone. At least that's how it feels.
I'm Sandy. Mary and I have talked. We're both depressed. But it's good to be in this group. You're lifted.
I'm Ed, and I was depressed when my wife told me I was going to Heart Lake this morning. No, I've got to go to class.
Would you please just say hi and wife?
Hi, I'm Karen.
My name is Sharon, and I'm here just to listen to people's ideas and really get focused on something. My focus is mostly mental health, but you know, I'm open to a lot of things.
I'm Julie, and I saw the word adversity in the list of programs, and it's pretty universal in all lives, so if I can learn something, great.
I'm David Eden, and I'm a retired mental health person. My wife and I are very interested in social justice, and I personally have never been arrested, but I did, like, unlike your friend who was about 35 times or something, and so there's a part of me that really admires that, but I've always been kind of a good boy, so I don't want to go that far.
I'm Jan. I'm a scientist. Educator, and I'm very concerned about a zillion things, but as a scientist, by the lack of or the denial of scientific fact and what we can learn from science and how important science is as a way for us to learn about the world. So that concerns me very much. That learning more about adversity and how to deal with it would be helpful.
I'm Sonia, and I've lived on San Juan Island for 33 years and recently remarried, and now go back and forth between Houston, Texas, and San Juan Island. And it has been, it is just so amazing how different it is from a population of 6,000 on an island to a city that created 188,000 new jobs last year. Mm-hmm. And I'm really concerned about the disconnect from what we hear in the news to what really is happening. Like there you hear, oh, our economy is sinking and trade is dropping off and all this, and then my husband and I take a drive down by the port and see the big ships coming and going and everything is just going great. Mm-hmm. Where is this? And then the other thing that I'm really concerned about is how different each state is. Mm-hmm. How are we all going to handle this? How this difference between states and attitudes based on who they are and who's there. And that's just an amazing country. Let's keep it together.
Hey, Bonnet from Wisconsin, and I was in the class yesterday, and a different topic, but I was really inspired by the class yesterday, and to see, you know, mean age around the group, probably somewhere between 60 and 80 or up, all looking to do something, and very, very sure that it was part of their responsibility. We need to keep at it, and maybe I was the only one that said it, but I want my grandchildren to see me at it too.
Mm-hmm. Jay Decker, and I'm just concerned about the divisions in our country and in our world. Instead of just being angry about it, maybe figure out a way to do something positive with it.
I'm Jonathan Ferrick, and I've been around international church organizations and meetings plenty for quite a while. where some really, really big ideas get articulated, and usually pretty good, and they're usually pretty far from what most congregations are talking about mm-hmm. in terms of the world and stuff. But I guess what keeps me going is the challenge of converting big ideas into achievable steps that lead in the same direction. And that was similar to the title of this session, I think. So it's, you know, how do you eat an elephant? Mm-hmm. It's that story. Anybody?
Well, thank you all. Excuse me.
Hi.
Oh, good to see
I'm back.
You. Yes. Good. Excellent.
If you don't mind, just introduce me. Yes. I'm Kathleen, and I'm from Minnesota. And something like you were just saying about the states and how are the states reacting. Well, Minnesota, you've got the corn growers that are being hurt by the tariff. And how are they responding? And there still are some that are going, yes, we'll pay. But you can tell in corn prices that they have hard as it is. You know, they don't need to have more challenges put out to them. But and also the other things that people, you know, the divisiveness that, you know, is, you know, just brought up and sort of cornering people, saying, oh, you are a white retired person, you must be, you must vote for such and such a person. Or also if you say that you're a Christian, they'll say, oh, that therefore you must be evangelical. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you must, well, you know, evangelical in which way, you know, but it's sort of, you know, like, oh, evangelical, so again, you must be for these particular ideas. And on top of like what you were saying, the fact that a lot of times they'll say that people that are older, you know, that they'll again typecast and say, hey, wait a minute, we were the ones in the 60s that were, you know, protesting and hippies and stuff. So, we were out there. So don't put, you know, retirees in as thinking as just as, you know, lumping everybody together a certain way. Anyway.
Thank you.
Pardon me?
So any other questions anyone want to ask from these introductions while we're all fresh?
Sure.
Yeah. So this is so wonderful. Yes, we should all get in a circle. And I want to give a full disclosure.
I need help to get
I want to, yeah, let's get you in there. You don't need a double chair. What can get you a better, yeah. That is not too comfortable. here, maybe we'll just get you.
Yeah, you got it. Yay. Great.
So great, thank you. So what I would like to do is just really quickly try to give you a sense of what to expect over these next 2 hours. And very importantly, I really want to say, I am totally fine if you want to get up, if you want to move, if you want to leave partway through, if you want to just let me know if I am speaking too fast or if there is something that you would like to develop. This is an extraordinary group based on what I've seen so far this week. And so I completely changed my presentation in light of the really wonderful conversations that we had on the first 2 days. But what my hope for today is, we will start off with just, I'll briefly let, for people that haven't been as a part of our group, what we were trying to tackle in the first 2 days. And then today is really a day to share stories and to really reflect and engage. And I will use some of my experience of some of the people that I have seen and how they have kind of been able to sustain their commitments but I really want to be honest with you that if you get a chance in the Holden bookstore, they say kind of favorite reads, and I will just tell you the best thing that I can offer is a reading list. And one of the books that I love is a collection of essays, and I'll pass this around, by Paul Loeb, and it's called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And I had used this in teaching, and I'll start passing it around. This is what I love to do. I had used this in teaching. I also had used, this is Oxford Press, but it's a really wonderful, you can get it at your library. It's called Approaches to Peace. And it's also a collection of essays. And it comes at it and tackles issues of social change in so many different ways that I find helpful. So I'm just going to pass this along in terms of, it helps you to sort of think about, there's just so many ways that you can address and tackle these problems, and so many tremendous thinkers that have come before us that I think are helpful. So I'll just pass that around. And then I hadn't told anyone about this earlier on. I first had introduced myself that I had been an undergraduate, had graduated from college in 1982, was thinking I'd go off to California, find my life, that the Reagan era, the heightened rhetoric, terrified me. I was an anthropology major, and I felt I needed to go volunteer for something. And I found an individual and an organization called the Institute for Defense and Disarmament Studies. And just by chance, I said, I want to volunteer. I have to do something this summer. I went in and I got a job. And that completely changed my life and the trajectory of my life. So that's sort of the piece that was my background. I worked for a few years. The woman who directed it and many others were working on the nuclear freeze campaign. And she started out with a modest goal of abolishing war. But it wasn't just that. She had a way of analyzing and thinking about the problems of war and peace. And she saw it as kind of an onion, of peeling away different pieces of the onion, bit by bit. And she had this incredible analytic mind. And so she was first a secretary at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. She then went to graduate school, but then she really studied what were the purposes and uses of force, what were the fears about war. And she came up with a step-by-step approach of how to tackle what everyone saw as such a big, daunting, scary time and problem of the nuclear arms race and East-West tensions, heightened rhetoric and fears during the Cold War between Reagan and the Soviet Union, and had this, okay, one first step. And then she was able to, through unbelievable arguments, fights, debates, organize many other grassroots groups and coalitions, and they worked with her to promote these ideas over years. So I found that fascinating. I also found it as successful as it was in mobilizing the public, raising awareness, having things happen, I got kind of burnt out. And so I decided that I really wanted to be an educator. So I went back to graduate school at MIT in the Defense and Arms Control Program, because I realized citizen activists in that era tended to be dismissed and marginalized. And I wanted to first learn the language, be knowledgeable, and really try to engage. And I had this extraordinary experience at MIT in that time. You had this, and in Cambridge and Boston, you had a mix of all different types of people, from Manhattan scientists, people that working with contractors, people in the government. But there was a heightened sense of concern and focus on issues of war and peace. So that was my background. But this is just one book, and what I found again and again was what I drew in terms of my, I had my deep-seated values and commitments, but I was just this confused kid. I didn't know what first, what was important. I'd try something. I didn't know if I was good enough at it. I was just kind of still confused about that. And I worked as a research assistant for graduate students. There is a wonderful really famous person, Karl Deutsch, who was a professor of peace. And he had a whole host of graduate students that were looking at peace education and trying to help and understand and nurture the next generation for how you live a life of commitment. And they studied different people and different backgrounds. And I was one of the people they interviewed of kind of what it was. And if you ever read this book, it's called Common Fire, Lives of Commitment in a Complex World. I'm not going to tell you my name, but I was the sweet one that was very confused and had her heart in the right place, knew she wanted to do things, but she wasn't quite sure how best to have an impact. Full disclosure, there are others that were just amazing from the get-go dynamos that were doing all these different things that are profiled in this book, but I didn't get a chance to say that yet this week. But it's a wonderful collection that this is in the Holden Library. And then finally, I just want to tell you, when I teach, I find it is so helpful for us to kind of have, depending on what you care about, stories and lives and people that we can sort of use as we're kind of trying to navigate and think and learn from. And one of the best books that I have used in teaching, this is called Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World. Has anyone heard of Paul Farmer? Okay, so at the time, this is somebody who was an anthropologist and a doctor who, at Harvard Medical School, who just fell in love and had studied Haiti. And Haiti had just enormous health challenges, military coups, inequalities, suffering so many problems. And he pioneered this idea of setting up health clinics that were by trained staff and fully resourced in different communities in Haiti. And this is a story about his extraordinary efforts. So it's a really wonderful one because the Mountains Beyond Mountains refers to a proverb, a traditional Haitian proverb, and it's both inspiring in terms of, as we had talked about earlier this week, of, you know, we all care about, we're all concerned. That's what's so wonderful about this group. We're all here with shared values and commitments. But then how do we find those pieces and steps? What next? That we can really find our center of gravity that will make a difference. And as we talked about yesterday, that, you know, you don't have to be a genius. You don't have to be an extraordinary leader. But what you do need is this idea of a community, a network, a group of other people, organizations, teams, where you can collaborate and work together and network to leverage your concerns into specific actions and campaigns. So just so that you know, we are... we are building upon... starting from the most important thing and being here this week at Holden, we are monks and you have this blessing of a time where you can kind of reflect on what it is within yourself, that spark, the things you care about. When you just have enough downtime and that luxury of sort of having the space to think about it, to just reorient with your core beliefs, values, and sources of motivation. So go with your strengths. You know, that's really the key, and what's really authentic. And then starting to think about where are other people and organizations that have possibilities that you're kind of curious about or that you know that have shared aims and values, and really start to touch base with them to develop a plan of action. And what's nice about this group is I feel you all have been at this for long enough in your lives. I don't have to worry about the sort of young people sort of have the sense, I'm going to change things immediately. It's all, you know, no good. But you have a better appreciation. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of things that are being tried. How can you build upon them? How can you really try to gain strength depending on changed circumstances and your interests? And this is where I feel more than ever we need to kind of go back and recognize. And I have an additional agenda. In addition to today, my goal here is to work with people in Holden Village to develop a series of podcasts and oral histories, because what I find is so remarkable is that Holden Village, over its history, the people that had been here before, longtime visitors, and people that work here year-round, provide tremendous wealth of insight and inspiration in terms of how you build a community and engage stakeholders in a way that reflects core values of positive social change. And let's face it, you know, you have collaboration, but you also have your fair share of controversy, of hardship, of differences that Holden and all of us have had to try to work through. And as much as it is, and I just can't tell you how wonderful it is to have that high of coming together with people, having a goal, working together, gaining those friendships. But as we talked about yesterday in terms of individual social change leadership, you also have to deal with the fact that you're around a lot of other strong-willed, highly ambitious and motivated people, and there's going to be intense differences, debates, arguments, and how you handle that conflict with civility. And this is that kind of fine art, and again, I'm a political scientist, I have to make clear, I'm not a social worker. Mel Jacobs gave an amazing, and he's doing an amazing series of sessions of dealing with loss, and it was very thought-provoking. I heard his session yesterday, he'll be again tomorrow. But this issue of working through with various community and stakeholders, that a lot of times that's the key point that you see where people get disillusioned, they get cynical, they can burn out. And so it's sort of learning within yourself that model of leadership to kind of stay with it. And what I actually appreciate about all of you is you all, you're more mature, so you recognize that challenge. So it's like, I feel like that's most of it. As long as you recognize it's there, then you'll start to do the self-care and the awareness to try to sort of strategize with that. But what I'm hoping to do is we will get into these stories and sharing. And I think it will be, given what I've already heard from people, because people didn't have the opportunity to do different readings outside of the session, I think we're going to start with our own stories of how people have stood up to adversity and sustained their commitments and adapted. I have mine on the PowerPoint, but I'm hoping rather than doing that, we'll be able to do that. So I want to just do a little bit more about this issue of agenda setting. And I got into my field from this interest in peace education, from values, from cultures. And what I realized very quickly was I loved talking to small groups and other things, but that really if I wanted to affect the change that I cared about, I had to grapple with things at the city level, at the state level, and at the federal level. And that fundamentally is issues of laws and public policy. So I want to just, if you will forgive me, I want to just talk to you a little bit about this, because this is the key piece of the puzzle that I think is a key dimension. That if we are, it's all well and good to have kind of a nice, wonderful coming together and feel good, but if you're really trying to make positive change, this requires really going forth and really trying to change existing status quo. So I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because there are so many ways, and there is this really rich array of activists that have been more or less successful at figuring out how to plug into existing, we can call them stakeholders, people in a position of power and authority, and really figuring out how to get into and address existing policies, to change them, to challenge them, and to then take advantage of what we call windows of opportunity and turning points that can contribute to successful campaigns. So again, the topic for today, and as I'm hearing you, most of you are really interested in overcoming adversity, and that is something that is very fundamentally important, more than anything, I think, and that is a key piece of it, so we will talk about it, but what I am hoping is that will come out in terms of our conversation. I'm not going to offer you any sort of little punch card of the things, except to tell you about certain types of leadership models and personalities and campaigns that have been able to kind of morph and regroup and also fail. Like, you can learn from important failures as a way of, okay, the next time we will try to do it differently. But it's really more important, I think, of how we cope with setbacks and changing circumstances. And so that's kind of just tilting how you think about it is a way of, it's not a question of whether the glass is half empty or half full. It's just dealing with what you have and then moving forward. So what I found yesterday that was so useful is that a lot of the conversation in terms of concerns about what's happening in the world, what's happening in our country, polarization, issues of Roundup, sanctuary cities, ICE, all these different conflicts, when I really pulled back and thought about it, I realized that it's a part of this larger, profound concern about human rights. And human rights is hand in hand with issues of justice, social justice. So I wanted to kind of put it in a perspective, because I think over time, you know, there's sort of these different pieces that we have face. And for me, sometimes it's helpful. I teach a course in foreign policy, and we call it enduring debates. So I still totally fundamentally believe in that long arc that we're making progress, but you also have to understand in the United States, we go back and forth in extremes, and we have a long history of that, and yet we have persisted and survived. So what I wanted to just share with you as we're thinking about issues in our community and adversity is, at the core, there is this tension in our society, in our democracy, in the way that we handle individual liberties, the idea of a limited role of government, this notion on paper of equality, and in fact, the fundamental, glaring, horrific gap between the principles that we hold dear and the practices and realities that we experience in this country. And that is a lot of what's bubbling up right now in a fundamental way. So you see this, and it comes, depending on different issue areas that you're interested in terms of it will play out with competing priorities and alliances. And again, I study very carefully, you know, in terms of in the Senate and the House, party politics, who's on what side, they're usually different issue areas. And you see, you know, they say strange bedfellows or alliances. And what's very unsettling for me is we have these periods of realignment, of protest and change. And what you see right now is that there are a number of competing priorities and alliances that are playing themselves out, that are fighting it out, where it's uncertain where people stand, who are your allies, how do you look? And this is especially clear in terms of the erosion of the focus and attention and legal system that we have had in this country with respect to human rights. So, you know, I just, for the purposes of conversation, we've always had these fights. And I this is what's really fun going back in time of, like, talking about, you know, these enduring debates. But for today, we really have this tension with the Trump presidency. It's an outlier in terms of an executive and what's been happening. But in a much more ongoing way, you have had fights and different struggles in terms of economic and military interests when you're talking about human rights. And so this sort of plays itself out domestically and internationally. And again, as we're thinking of kind of adversity and how we deal with adversity, sometimes it's helpful to, rather than just get furious, to understand that there really is a disconnect in what we see between what's happening at the rhetorical level and what's happening in terms of action and policies in the government. And this is where I have moved, and I'd like to educate students. You know, you can't just vilify, and you can't sort of talk about a unitary actor of a Donald Trump or anything out. That really, if you're really trying to get an understanding, you need to get into these institutional bureaucratic politics and policy process, and very importantly, understanding these core interests and missions. So that's kind of if you want to change something, you need to know, what was it created to do? Who are the people that are promoted? How bureaucratically are they advanced? And where are your opportunities to have input and to disrupt? Yeah.
Laura, I mean, aside from the frequent and gross lies, does anyone actually know what the Trump administration is trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. I mean, the tariffs, it's unclear what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
There is no goal that is...
Yeah. So this is where, take my foreign policy plan, I'm teasing. But there's, I mean, so in terms of the economic stuff, what I would have said 2 years ago is, so we are an old government. And especially at the national level, in terms of economic interests and military interests, there has been tremendous continuity. And what you see is, yes, you have Democrats and Republicans getting in office, but things, you know, in terms of changes to NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Association Agreement, those economic interests, those are relatively minor in terms of what actually was agreed to and what its impact is, in contrast to what you're raising of the rhetoric and what Trump is saying about tariffs and these different ways in which he has actually been creating a lot of impact in the short term. What's interesting is, if you had asked me, and this is what I told everyone, with the first Secretary of State, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was supposed to be this big trade agreement that was going to, you know, kind of address concerns about Chinese trade, the shift of what's been happening in the Pacific, that I would have thought that Trump would have gone with that entrenched interest, because there are a lot of very powerful players. But I'll talk a little, I will talk a lot more about that. But Trump has created a lot of uncertainty in terms of these core things, especially for me, in terms of military interests. And you have this fundamental question in terms of, yes, on the one hand, he says he loves the generals, but, you know, in terms of what's been said about NATO, in terms of different actions that have been taken, it's kind of unsettled. But all my colleagues and people that study the whole thing about these governmental institutions is they're very insular, they have established procedures, and it's, you know, it is like trying to turn an aircraft carrier. You can't just shift it on a dime. It's been designed over many years not to be susceptible to outside impacts, and that there are a lot of these institutional sort of structures and career individuals that help us to understand why it is so hard to have meaningful, significant change. So you kind of have to be aware of that coming in. But finally, so you have this disconnect. The thing about it right now for us is that we go back and forth between fundamental norms and the importance of norms. I feel so happy here at Holden. There is such wonderful overlap from the Vesper service and the song about resilience. And so much of the values and norms of this community resonate for me and sort of with what the ideas of this workshop were in terms of how we think about living a life of commitment, living in a just, moving toward a positive social change, a better world. That is certainly important. On the other hand, you are constrained fundamentally by laws. And the thing about the United States is we love our laws. Especially if you go elsewhere, you realize that this is a key piece that, you know, up to a certain point, you really have to understand the way in which our institutional structures, our legal structures, and the allocation of resources, budgets, all of those things are dictated, taxes on out. So this is where it's important to kind of recognize that as you're looking at the debate and what people have talked about with human rights. So anyway, I don't want to talk too long because we're going to get into other things. Long story short, you want to deal with adversity? Here it is. You got your little emergency guide. This is your little, I'm not offering this, obviously. We have this way in which there are no simple fixes. I have a very dear friend that talks about the fact that we have this apocalyptic strain in our society and that we go back and forth from red scares, from all these different things to think, the world is falling apart. You know, it's very popular to talk about zombies and other things among young people. I'm not suggesting that there is any simple way that we can kind of guarantee that there's a survival kit. So that is not what I can suggest. But what I do think is what we will find, and I think what can help us. I remember when I was a kid, I was all upset about things, and my mom said to me, you know, when they first discovered gunpowder, they thought that the world was going to end. And she went through all these different radical technologies. With the advent of nuclear weapons, the world was going to end, and that we were able to make adaptations and change. And I found that not totally reassuring, but I was trying to take into account that there are these periods where you have disruptive technologies, these very enormous fundamental forces, it's hard to see it on the ground, that are transforming things, and you have to make adaptations. And this is the key piece of adaptations, resilience, and how you cope with the adversity that's associated with it, which I think is helpful. So what I would like, and I'm going to stop talking very quickly because this is not a lecture, this is going to be a discussion, but what I was excited today was for us to share, and I have stories too from people on the front lines. And what you have found again and again is there is this ebb and flow. There are life cycles of social movements, and you come up against at a certain point, depending on how ambitious the cause or issue that you care about, that there's a recognition of there is an importance of the policymaking process. And so that's where I'm going to just kind of put in a plug so that you can be savvy as you organize and think and engage. And that what you see is people, there are so many wonderful, lovely people that live remarkable lives of commitment. But if you're really trying to make social change, you need to have knowledge and persistence to deal with changing laws and policies. And so, again, translate that into our own lives. On the one hand, the more you learn about, you know, the way you make the sausage in terms of policy, it's hard to fight off about cynicism and powerful players and moneyed interests and all these different things. But, you know, you need to be literate about that. You need to be aware of that. At the same time, what you see and what I have been so amazed with is that as you work on these things, and again, finding your village, your group of stakeholders, you will build up a shared community of trust, of knowledge that is crucial to being successful, moving forward, being aware of when is it time to work those extra hours to try to get something through, to have either the meeting, the petition, the action, and other times like, okay, it's not the right cycle in the process, just, you know, you get to be here at Holden for a week and jumpstart your batteries. And this is the key piece in terms of sustaining participation, that this is really a big piece as we think about this. The participation piece, and for me, it is, there are just so many different ways that we can participate and have tremendous impact. And that's, again, in the leadership model, as you kind of think through your own values, what we did yesterday, and kind of thinking through, you know, these seven C's of how you fit into that social change model and can take leadership and participate in a way that will sustain you and work with others in a positive, synergetic way. So I'm going to just throw out this picture, and then I'm going to stop talking because I don't want to talk for too long. We're going to take a break at 2:30. It's a little blurred. But what is interesting is each of you, as you introduced yourselves and discussed what you saw were your concerns and problems, the question is, how do these concerns get on the agenda of government action to be addressed in terms of our wider society? And what you see is people that have kind of studied this, as you're looking at the government and policy making and things going on in the world, it's kind of useful to think about these three streams. They're all going along. They have all these issues and problems and activities. They're a problem stream, a policy stream, and a politics stream. So most obviously, the politics stream, I'm not going to go on, but you have just the most polarized with Trump, his tweets, an election coming up. you have, you're all familiar with sort of those types of things, what are being debated and are hot button tickets as we hear them in the news media. In terms of the policy stream, let's just take an issue that somebody is following. What issue is somebody following that they'd like to share in terms of the cycle of policy of what's coming up? Yeah. Yes, climate change. So what are the key issues from EPA regulations, international treaties, state laws, the Energy Department? What are some others that are in the policy stream that are being discussed?
Energy, did you say energy?
Yes, energy. Okay,
going back to coal, or are we going to go with renewable, cleaner?
I just talked to an individual, and we were talking about, you know, for the benefit of moving to solar and whether or not you can buy it or rent it, the tax incentives, the quotas in each state, how that is playing out. That has been ongoing. It's just, you know, you have it at the state level. You also have it at the federal level through the Energy Department, and from getting a tax write-off, from doing basic research, from, you know, supporting different research efforts. So this is an ongoing in the policy stream. Yeah.
There's also the various state parks that are being shrunk.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Including in Minnesota, it's the Boundary Waters that we have some issues with that.
Right.
And are open to commercial activity.
Yes, what's open to commercial? Yes, from the Alaska National Forests, different activities in Massachusetts, offshore wind, all of these different, yes, absolutely. So that is, if you care about renewable energy, alternative energy, reducing your fossil imprint, there are these ongoing, and it takes many years. And we're going to get into, but I want to, you know, so basically, I just want to jump ahead, that there are any number of policy entrepreneurs that are aware of these policy streams, and you know it's coming up to the legislature, or there's a decision, or there's, you know, a public input point. But most importantly, you have people within the government, elected officials, who are responsible for these. And becoming aware, you go to their websites, and I can tell you, in my area, there's a whole calendar of these different things. And it happens, you know, 6 months in advance, there's this and that, it has to be presented, they're required by law, present the national security strategy of the U.S., they highlight these things. If you have the budget debate, you know, there's a whole very organized process that's in its own stream. So being aware of that is helpful to you, and it just operates, doesn't matter, except there were these things with the government shutdown this year where certain things, you know, it was, you know, just shocking to me in terms of, you know, with essential, non-essential workers and what was happening. You do have disruptions. But barring that, you have this routine, ongoing operation. So you need to know those policy streams. And so this is the thing, though, because I was talking, I wanted to have you, as you're thinking about how you sustain your commitment, how you deal with a sense of kind of powerless and being on the outside, it's for you to get savvy and to think of yourself as a policy entrepreneur and looking around at others that are looking at opportunities, looking at these ideas, how you can plug in, and at different moments when it's more or less likely to be effective. So what you see is, you know, you start off here, and when you think about this, it's like basically, as we've expressed more or less, a straightforward concern about certain problems. We all care about something. We want to take action on it. You also have, and this is just a part of our democracy, this is how we organize, is that you have the pursuit of self-serving benefits, such as protecting or expanding a bureaucracy's budget or claiming credit for an accomplishment. I mean, that is legitimate interest from, you know, the local tourism office, the Defense Department, to EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. These bureaucracies, obviously committed people are there, they have a mission, they believe in it, and they want to have not only resources to do it, which means budget, but also they want credit. And this is one of the things that people don't realize, and it's not just about sort of money, it's also about information and being able to have that kind of, we are the ones that offer these things. So that is something that is important. You also have this classic idea of promoting the values of an organization. And this is where, again, coming at it in different ways, as you're thinking about, you come up at loggerheads with one organization that's identifying the problem that you care about. You go to a different agency, they could be your ally. And that's because of different policy values on the part of different organizations. So, for example, yeah.
Laura, we've been at this for 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And I really am curious. I really want to.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say this.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
I really want to hear the rest of the room talk.
Absolutely. Thank you. Absolutely. So let's start. Yes, absolutely. Go for it. Yes.
That was interesting. In Washington, I was in a Democratic meeting, and the council mayor of Bellevue came and they said, well, why isn't a sanctuary free state for the immigrants or sanctuary city? And they said, well, you know, I have instructions to the police department. He's supposed to pass down that we're not supposed to be apprehending anybody or stopping anybody or asking them anything about their status other than getting a driver's license. In Washington State, you can still get a driver's license if you're not a citizen or a legal resident. And that was different than Seattle. Oh, they said, well, you know, why? Well, we're looking for a really big allotment for, I don't know if it was a highway or what it was, but we're not messing with this for some time, because it doesn't matter. We're not going to do it. For Seattle, it was, we're a sanctuary city, and being one of the first or second ones, it had raised a bunch of feathers back east.
So those are the organizational quotas, the institutional incentives. Excellent.
I was attracted to this seminar because of the word adversity, which I think is universal in each life, and you've taken it to a national, international, global place. But I also think the word applies on a very individual, personal level, and that we're old, you know. Time is very precious with us. What impact have you had in your life, and what can you do with this precious little piece that's left? Mm-hmm. Now that we're old and wise, and nobody's listening to us. But I think it does help a lot to be aware of that. And not become, maybe it's better to put it more positive, just each person that you happen to run into in your life, that person is as important as any other person, whether they're powerless or a kid or whatever they are. So work with what you have. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, I'm curious that climate change. They now have organizations throughout all different cities and states where you can join, sort of like clubs, and that you can meet and do some things. I haven't heard anything similar to that about, besides the fact of having sanctuary cities, of groups getting together to do something about the immigrant, to help for it.
Yeah, so people, have a direct experience?
In Seattle, and I think Bellevue also, there are some interfaith groups that have organized around the sanctuary movement and care for immigrants. So, for instance, Gethsemane Lutheran Church in downtown Seattle had an individual in sanctuary for a year in their church. And then there were a wide variety of faith organizations, Christian, of all many denominations, folks from the Jewish community, etc., that came together to support that conversation. congregation that decided to do the super brave and scary thing of having somebody in sanctuary in their church and what that meant for their pastors and what that meant for the congregation. Many of the other faith organizations, including the church that I go to, then organized, you know, one person in each organization that would disseminate information down to the other folks that were interested in the congregation or temple or whatever type of faith organization it was, to go to rallies and to raise money to, you know, because this individual was the breadwinner of, well, still is the breadwinner of his family. He's now in detention because he had to go appear in front of ICE, and they seized him at that time, which was a known risk. So he's in detention now, but he was in sanctuary there for a year. So that's an example of a whole bunch of faith communities coming together to support one church that made the decision to have somebody in sanctuary in their building.
So possibly contact, I mean, like I know that the Twin Cities has an interfaith group committee to see what they can do, because I mean that would be a larger organization.
Yeah, or to see if there are individual faith communities that decided to be sanctuary, sites of sanctuary that may have somebody in sanctuary and need some support. You know, there's so many different ways that support is needed in those situations. Money, prayer, people showing up at vigils and protests.
It's wonderful. If you don't have it already, in our town we have, it's called Sanctuary in the Streets. And because churches are on the front lines, but the idea is that we have a hotline. So we are all, it's a phone tree, it's now actually texting. If anyone is rounded up, you get it, everyone rushes in there and draws attention, and especially with ICE and different things like that. And if people are detained, then you have a whole phone tree, you get in the press, you go and meet, you meet with your representative. They organized a session that took to the State House to try it, because there are sort of different rules and regulations at the federal and state level in terms of cities and how ICE can act. And it's really quite dramatic and
is
exciting.
Is that in Amherst?
It's in Northampton. Well, it's in the Pioneer Valley. So the main areas where it's affecting is in cities in Springfield and Holyoke. We're more undocumented. And we do have people that have been in sanctuary churches. But it's, again, most importantly, with these different roundups that have happened. And that's another thing of people leaking information, blowing the whistle on ISIS raids, or, you know, sort of where they're targeting. And that's been tremendously effective. And that's where citizens and that action has been really, it's remarkable with these new technologies. Do people have stories of that?
Yeah, we had a big raid in southern Minnesota just about 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was devastating. For the families.
Did I hear that the Lutheran Church as a whole has become like a sanctuary?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that is
awesome.
But to me, that's very powerful.
Yeah.
It may really start to affect other, you know, communities.
Yeah, and so it's changed in terms of the pleas. They're like, send in diapers, send in this and that for people that are in sanctuary, and then also sending letters and drawing attention that for individuals that are in detention or that are separated from families. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important, like you said, you know, I understand that this is the case. And as individual congregations, I think we need to ask for information so we understand what that means and how we contribute to that.
Yeah. So that's just to remind me that we, in a few seconds, as soon as people finish their sentence, I want to make sure you guys get a 10-minute break, because this is a long session, so you can get up and move around.
Did everybody hear about the Dutch church that had a prayer service for, I think, 5 weeks, right?
No.
Because there's a law in Holland that the police can't enter a religious establishment when a worship is going on. So they had sanctuary families in there, and they kept a prayer service going 24/7.
Cool.
Week after week after week, it really got a lot of press.
Oh, wow.
Maybe there's little laws like that in your other state.
Oh, no.
And this has all been organized. This is one of the books that I suggested is called The Resistance, and it's different edited essays. And what's remarkable is there have been ongoing organizations. The Lutheran Church, others have been offering sanctuary for decades. But this tremendous, terrible focusing event has just totally galvanized and motivated. So, again, using the laws that provide for this law that ICE and other officials are not allowed to go into a church. And sort of, but this is where getting savvy about what these rules are, what they can and cannot do, either suing, getting injunctions, getting other people in place, but most importantly, mobilizing citizens to take action.
As far as I know, the church is exempt from those things. I mean,
right.
That they just can't walk in.
Right.
You can do it without a law.
Yes.
But other than trying to mitigate the harm that's being done, it would seem the big problem is this administration has to be defeated. And the problem is, unless people vote, mm-hmm. we're going to be looking at 4 more years of this person chipping away at what our democracy is. Mm-hmm. So I would think the most important strategy is to target, and I consider it an evil, getting people to respond to this mm-hmm. horrendous travesty of mm-hmm. I mean, you had a slide up there about stretching or breaking.
Mm-hmm.
The law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's clearly broken the law.
Yeah.
And he's only protected because of some policy that presidents can't be indicted on.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to be out of there.
Right.
We've never had it that I know of a criminal president before.
Yeah.
Nixon.
No.
Well,
yeah. So please feel free to get up, stretch, take a break. We'll keep talking informally, but then we'll regroup in 10 minutes at 2:40.
Help them. And when we want to make our children
Much more fun.
Yeah.
You might be.
Okay, so we are going to continue. So I want to do a check-in. I love these poems. So I have three things I'm hoping to accomplish. I have note cards. If anyone is provoked enough to come up with follow-up, either in terms of especially the types of questions and insights of overcoming adversity, living a life of commitment, we are going to be doing a series of interviews with people and sharing stories here at Holden. So if you wanted to write down any gems of questions and sort of things that you might think you would like to have addressed, we hope to be doing this in terms of podcasts and sort of thinking about trying to find people that kind of reflect these issues of concern for people here that are visiting here, as well as more widely in the community. So that's one piece. And if anyone wants to contact me, I have my business card, which has my cell phone and email. Especially a couple of people want to have materials. I have that here, if anyone wants that. So it's here. Okay, so then the third piece is, so our goals for today is sharing stories of recognizing that any number of people have, in terms of trying to pursue social change.
Is this for the faculty?
Sorry?
These are the question cards, or who's for the faculty?
This would be a larger project of it's not the faculty, the people that are part of the Holden community, either visitors, year-round residents, the people that are on the board or have worked and been involved. So we're hoping to do, they are just, I don't know if you've heard about this, but the podcasts are of the different special services and events that are here so that people can hear it year-round. So the idea is also to draw upon the rich experience and cares and concerns of people that are actually here in the village. So the idea is we will start this, but it'll go on for the next couple of years as they try to build up the podcasts here at Holden. So if anything from our conversations this week are things that you would like to hear from or continue with people who are somehow affiliated with Holden Village, I welcome you to write down any specific sort of gems or nuggets or things that you care about that you'd like to ask and have further conversation about. So, okay, we have prayers from different religious traditions. This is, again, what I like of as you, and I will continue with sort of more of a discussion, but I felt like we were just getting going, and I did want to give people a chance to have a break, but with this idea of the opportunity of people to build off of from their churches, from their communities, how you deal with this injustice, this upheaval and this outrage, these illegal activities that are happening. Does anyone want to continue, or what was some of the conversations during break that you'd like to share?
I think those were raised that she spoke about in Minnesota, okay. And the raids you talked about in Massachusetts, each time that sends a big fear into the heart of anybody that's illegal or Latino or
it has a chilling effect, and there's no question from, you know, we have what's called the Survival Center, from getting food for families in need and sort of any of these types of gathering places. It's absolutely created kind of fears. Public schools, taking your child, dropping them off at school or any of these organized places, it's absolutely, And at the same time, though, as much as I fundamentally agree, the presidential election is crucial. These next few months, it's not something that can be put off. And it can become a very important campaign issue. And in terms of mobilizing, you see this just as many decades ago, you find these different movements that become hot button issues, go to the front of the agenda on the campaign, and forcing different candidates to take positions, take actions, speak up about it, from various presidential candidates, going to the border, investigating at least going to the detention camps, those types of things. This is the way in which drawing that spotlight, that type of pressure politics is something that is really important, and that individuals, just sending a letter to your local rep, your state rep, what are you doing? Have you been there? Can you report back? It's amazing. And actually, I have my students, I'll jump ahead to this. I have my students pick a problem that they care about and then take action. And this is something that, again and again, what's really amazing is that getting them to realize that this is a picture from Montreal, by the way.
What is it?
It's the Montreal Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. And this is the main site in Montreal. So, what I would like to do is, somebody want to read out loud, actually, one of the poems? Anyone who's glanced at them, one that really resonates with them? And we'll start with that. They're not poems, prayers.
I'll read the first one.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, a Jewish prayer for peace. May it be your will, eternal one, our God, God of our ancestors, that wars and bloodshed be abolished from the world, and bring into the world a great and wonderful and lasting peace. And let no nation lift up sword against nation, let them learn no more the ways of war. Let all who dwell on earth simply acknowledge the truth of truths, that we have not come into this world for the sake of quarreling and war, nor for the sake of hatred, jealousy, anger, or bloodshed. Rather, we have come into this world only to know you. May you be blessed eternally. Therefore, have mercy on us and fulfill among us what is written in your Torah. I shall give peace upon the earth, and you shall lie down with no one to make you afraid. The sword shall never come upon your land. Justice shall roll down like waters, and righteousness like a mighty stream. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the omnipresent as the waters fill the seas.
I love this. What do other people think? It makes me feel better. What words or turns of phrase or ideas jump out at you from this prayer?
That we've not come into this world for the sake of quarreling and war, or hate, jealousy, anger, or bloodshed. Basically, our reason for being is not what we often get caught up in our day-to-day lives. So, trying to accomplish this or that in our jobs or disagreeing with other people.
Yeah, I love that. That's where I started out with that issue of kind of grounding and rebalancing. When you get all caught up in some controversy day to day, and then to have these words of wisdom and prayers to help you think about it. What are we here for? What about the whole, we're all familiar with the swords to plowshares, the way that it's presented in this prayer.
We could take the sword shall never come upon our land out of context and use that as a thing. Let's have a strong military defense so they never even think of coming on our shores.
Mm-hmm. Is it Shane Claiborne? Is that his name? He's been going around melting down, going to congregations. They've been bringing handguns. They've been melting them.
Yeah.
And turning them into tools of their
I don't know if you know, at UN headquarters in New York, they have that sculpture of swords into plowshares. That's now aged. They're debating what to do with it. How to fix it up. Right.
Oh, not aged by...
No, but it was built. It's now, you know, the concrete's crumbling. And this is, again, unfortunately, a similar, like, how you reform and update these institutions that were developed and built in a different time with different... concerns. But yeah, absolutely. Well, so what do other people think about that? The sword shall never come upon your land. Justice shall roll down like waters.
But, you know, my problem is this paradox of, I think everybody in this room wants peace. We all believe in peace, I think. And yet we live in a country that's buying more defense weapons and offensive weapons than any other country in the world.
Yeah.
And to me, it's absurd. I don't understand why there is an outrage mm-hmm. in our country about the way we're wasting money.
Mm-hmm. So here again, I want other people to speak, but this is what I've been so preoccupied with. And again, if you start looking at the way our government presents the budget, you have two totally separate systems. The military budget, that was passed with virtual no debate. It was actually more than what was requested from the Defense Department and others. Different things were presented that flew through both houses, yet the government shutdown was on the other half, civilian spending. And the public is not even aware that these two things were going on. And so this is, again, for me, the way in which, and forgive me, because I was wanting to get into the policy process that, as you said, many people have shared values and have concerns about, you see this in your communities, infrastructure, schools, all these things where it's been very, you know, hard in terms of providing public dollars for things we care about. And yet, why do we have this two-tiered system of increase in spending, even more than what's requested, and then a decline, and also a pressure down from what historically the federal government had covered, and states and local communities are having to pay a higher percentage. And that's sort of a piece, too, that's kind of one of these invisible pieces. But, you know, this is where I think knowledge is power. As you start to sort of see this, it's very easy to argue and debate about these specific things. It's not you're a good or bad person. It's not polarized. It's a certain type of focused debate. And then when it comes up again, it's like, okay, you have to pass them both together or figuring out different ways of setting limits. And in 2012, what's interesting is this was with the total cap in the federal debt. The whole reason it was a crisis was they included the military spending that you couldn't overgo. Am I going too far into the weeds for people? But this is, again, sort of this type of knowledge that the way in which the laws were made, the way in which it was regulated with the budget, the Defense Department, the military was directly affected in 2012 on out until it was changed recently in terms of the way in which the budget is done. And so now Congress lifted that cap, changing of the rules. So anyway.
Well, in the weeds, is it still, I mean, the best way to get your pork barrel project was to attach it to a defense.
Exactly.
So you could sneak in your bridge,
yes.
You know, or whatever. Can they still do that?
Absolutely. No, I can tell you, that's why I moved into the best way you talk about it in terms of, it's called the securitization of a project. You talk about it as a threat. I do political science and I do weapons of mass destruction. And if you look at from public health, all these other things, if you're interested in trying to get funding from the government, you talk about either bioterrorism or threats to public health as a security way you will get funding, because that's sort of viewed in a different pocket, in a different avenue than if you're talking about vaccinations for preschool kids or other types of health things that are seen as kind of civilian
concerns. Well, gun security, and, you know, our, what do they call it now? Gun safety? They relabel that.
Yeah.
You know, gun control.
Right.
But it's a public health problem.
Right.
So is that
That's why, I'm sorry, that's why I was getting into policy entrepreneurs. Yeah. Once you get a little savvy, it's not to make you cynical, but it's how you frame the issue, how you present it. Here's a problem, here are the policy streams, here are the people that care about it, how will it advance, and if you're looking at budgets, where is it expanding, where are the growth areas and opportunities?
I find it ironic that, or sad, that, I mean, basically this is all fear-driven, right? We fear the other, we want to have big walls at our borders so God forbid nobody can get in, but climate change.
Yeah.
What's that going to bring?
Yeah.
I mean, what's it bringing already? Lots of bad stuff.
Right.
But
terrible fire.
Yes. But people somehow, some people anyway, some people at very high levels in the current administration can ignore all of that, you know, and not, if they're going to raise fear about something, I'd rather have them raise some fear about climate change and what's coming for us if we don't make some big changes in how we live, rather than raising fear about socialism versus capitalism or the people that are fleeing violence in their own nations and trying desperately to find a safe place to come here.
Right.
Why do we fear them more than the melting of the damn polar ice caps that is going to affect the whole planet?
Yes. Well, so actually, you're identifying, and again, this is where you get into who are the actors? We have visible actors. You're talking about, again, this sense of fear, this climate of fear in the public. You also have a number of special interests that have been, and this is not just with the Trump administration, this went back to the Bush administration, in terms of the direct intervention of from lobbyists, from members of major fossil fuel corporations that were going into the administration, suppressing data, editing, changing reporting, limiting scientists' ability from going to meetings or publishing on their things. Not so invisible, but this is sort of interesting because, you know, again, these interest groups are able to block consideration of proposals. And this is what happened during the Bush administration, and it's gotten even more extreme under Trump in terms of climate stuff. And they are able to do it by, it's high on the agenda, they add elements a bit more to their liking, they initiate considerations or set agendas on their own. When they come in conflict with the combination of national mood, as you know, from hurricanes, from flooding, from these horrific impacts that are seen as being associated with problems of climate change, the question is, then, you know, how do they affect the elected politicians and prevail in setting an agenda? And so this is where trying to be aware as activists and organizers of recognizing, on the one hand, you're absolutely right, of identifying fear, identifying concern, and then how is it channeled, and seeing, in fact, the way in which it's not just the government, you have ads, you know, you have, and, you know, that's just the way in which our country works, but it's important to understand that, and then tackle it and, you know, call it in terms of saying, wait a minute, you're talking about this so-called study, you're saying this and that, that's not true, and providing avenues for accountability. We talked about this earlier on, how can you take, what tactics can you use to challenge these organized interests?
Yeah, from, someone holds a snowball in their hand and says, look, there's a snowball, how can there possibly be global warming?
Right.
I mean, come on.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, so this is, again, and what's, this has been ongoing, this has happened for a long time in our government, but it's gotten more extreme, and it's heightened by consolidation of news media. And this is one of the things, I have to go back to this one woman, Frances Crowe, who I talked about, who turned 100, because she got very concerned about this fact that, you know, these things were going on, she had these concerns, but the media was not picking up on it. And she came at this problem again and again. She was concerned about nuclear energy, dangers of nuclear energy, the war, its environmental impacts on our society, and yet it wasn't getting the attention that she thought it deserved. So she was looking around, and she came across this news outlet. It's called Democracy Now! Has anyone heard of Democracy Now! Well, back, you know, many decades ago, it had just been started up by Amy Goodman, a tiny bit. So she called up our local radio station and said, I want you to air it. It's broadcast, I think, 2 hours every day. The radio station in Northampton said, forget it. We have other programming we want to do. So she set up a radio tower and a ham operator in her backyard, two blocks from where I live, and started piping out the radio. And this was 20 years ago. And so I'm trying to say, you know, you have these massive problems. She was so worried about, this was in the 90s, the aftermath of the war, and then in the early 2000s. And she's like, if you're not going to air it, I'm going to do it. And it's like sort of this can-do spirit that is remarkable. So she started doing that, and not just that, I was teaching at the time. She would nag me. I'd see her in the street. She'd like, why aren't you telling your students about this radio show, this and that? I had gone to college with Amy Goodman. I knew her, but I was like, oh, I just was busy, you know. And so, in a way, she tirelessly talked it up. I said, I got to listen to it. I listened to it. I was like, oh, this is good. And over time, she was able. It is now nationally broadcast. It's available. You can get it as a podcast. And it's just a wonderful example of, she worked with many other people, but this issue of finding these key leaders, these issues that you care about, and coming at it from a different way of like, we've got to get out this information, because otherwise you're just going to see this person with a snowball. People are going to think, oh, that explains it, and sort of getting these alternate sources. So,
did she just stick to one issue?
No, this woman has more energy, and she has a whole different networks. But she had it. She became a Quaker, and so she was always anchored in kind of faithful activists, but civil disobedience, and worked with different communities every Saturday. It was no to war. They had a vigil on the street corners to draw attention to that, and then had different mobilizations. And I worked with a program called Peace and World Security Studies. So we would do things both in the community and on campuses. And she was always giving me a hard time. I wasn't ever doing enough. And, you know, or I was driving my car to a meeting and I should have taken the bus. And I was like, but I have kids. I need to get home. You know, but it was good. She was my conscience. But it was good. You know, it's like that tension. But also, she is somebody. And literally, she is, there's a mural in our town. And, you know, again, it's just sort of so interesting over time where it's a mural that talks about not just her, but all these other women that have had impacts, you know, in terms of in the community. So there are all these ways. Actually, you were asking me, like, that's one of the things artists can do things. Every time we go by, we are so inspired by this mural. It's just beautiful people doing things, and it's just on somebody's wall, but it really does have an impact. Yeah. So, okay, more stories. Jonathan, you want to share some? Are you feeling able to be put on the spot?
Yeah, in what field?
So think about it, how you've overcome adversity, how you've sustained your commitment, as you've been just totally...
Well, one thing I would say, and it's a little simple, but I get the reaction of sort of, that if you work on nuclear disarmament, this late stage, most people have forgotten about it. They don't even remember what a threat it was in the 80s. It's no less a threat today. And it's ironically not the only way we can destroy ourselves. Now we can also destroy ourselves with climate change, you know. And so, and I'm always stunned by the question of why, how you work on something so difficult. And I don't know what to say, but my real feeling is, how can you not work on it?
Yeah.
And I think I say that not as a pig-headed person, but as a Christian. It's kind of like creation is so special, and we're part of it, and we need to take responsibility for it. And a lot of things we're talking about is us giving up on our responsibilities. That thing you just had up there, the idea of the threat to media,
mm-hmm.
you know, just as one example, where the U.S. and the world seems to be heading is forget journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Just read what you want
it's
to read.
It's opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the truth is whatever you say.
Then you're a sitting duck for
yeah.
the Trumps of the world and the
yeah.
fascists and the bigots.
Yeah.
And that is really scary. So
yeah.
that made me think is, where's the debate about freedom of the press? The stuff that was thrown out
yeah.
from the Warren Court about equal time, fairness doctrine, all those things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like we don't have to reinvent these wheels. They're
yeah.
there. They've just been cast aside.
Yeah.
When is Facebook and those guys going to be treated like a media who
yeah.
has the same liabilities that media used to have and all media need to have? So there's pretty straightforward
yeah.
solutions. And climate, I think, again, we can all look at our own carbon footprint and make slow, little changes and encourage others and turn around. So I think if you're living with a little bit of common sense, I can't do anything about the media crisis, but I watch many of the people I know being mostly informed by their prejudices,
mm-hmm.
by not paying attention. You know, how many people actually sit down and watch a decent newscast?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, I find that deeply troubling. Where's the debate on that? So that isn't very helpful to say, but what I'm trying to say is I think our faith calls us to be the nice Jewish phrase, tikkun olam, you know, healers, tenders of the world. And we all have different interests. And if we're all working in our areas, then when we come together, we can talk about concrete steps we're taking
mm-hmm.
in the areas that matter most to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we can borrow other people's behaviors and adopt them to make a bigger impact. And then church becomes a family of people who are strengthening each other because they are committed. And it's little things. It's not big things.
Right.
The big ones I mentioned just now because I'm so frustrated about them. I don't have the answer to those.
Yeah.
But paying attention to the Amy Goodmans, but then you will listen to, is there a good conservative commentator somewhere?
Yeah,
excellent.
There are.
And that's the engaging with, that's what I meant by teaming and gaining trust, because that's where. I want to jump on what you said, because what's amazing here in Washington State, for me, Holden Village is just such a wonderful model with the remediation, Superfund of the Mind, this coexistence, but still keeping to these core values. Washington State has, how many of you know about Hanford Reservation? So for me teaching students, you know, I can go on and on and on. It's all very removed. And then I get to them about the environmental impacts, leaching, all the contamination and the dangers of explosions. And they take off. And they're shocked. They don't know about it. They aren't aware about it. And there are people, and also with Subic, you know, you have wonderful local hooks and handles that help them to feel like, oh, I do care about that, from water supply, from other issues, to understand also the environmental legacy of these activities that were done and how they stay with us, and issues of transgenerational justice. Mm-hmm. So sort of, and that's why I keep teaching this course, Citizenship of the Nuclear Age, because they get, there's such great literature, but they just kind of grew up with, it just hasn't been on the radar, but you can really get people up to speed, and it's not controversial in a way that it used to be, in terms of if you're patriotic, you would support it no matter what. Now people, you know, feel, but it is, and that's where Holden is such a wonderful example of starting locally. You know, there was this opportunity, but dealing with the contamination from this mine and the struggle, and, you know, sort of the continuing legacy, still though kind of working hand in hand while keeping to the core commitments. And yeah.
So a big part of the challenge, though, I think, is there's so many things that are problems, and how do you decide what you're going to do, and then get plugged into people, like-minded people that you can network with. I'm wondering if anyone has any words of wisdom in that area.
Anyone want to share?
Well, I mean, we get powerful enemies. The Koch brothers, they're billionaires many times over, and they are actively promoting climate change, you know, because it's petrochemical. I know it's not fun, but get active with your local party. And I'm not going to say D word, but yeah, it's the Democratic Party. We've got to get them more cohesive, because right now, what message are you getting out of the Democratic Party? It's socialist or moderate, and they're not cold. We're hoping they will coalesce at some point. But trying to get involved in, you know, the local political movement, because otherwise I don't see a lot of hope. Trump got in because people didn't vote.
Yeah.
I mean, there was voter suppression, that's clear. But a lot of people who could have voted didn't, and were paying for it. And so people need to know, if you don't get out to vote, you know, bad things are store for this country.
And there is a changing shift of young people don't see their idea of citizenship as going out to vote. They see it as engaging in different ways in their communities. So that's another way of kind of recognizing, okay, go where their interests and energy is. And, you know, this came up yesterday of, like, sort of having the, on Sundays in the afternoon in the park, having different gatherings, and sort of not having it be the formal traditional way early in the morning at church, but having other ways that...
Voter registration.
Right, exactly. Yes, yes. And there's a very clear example where, again, that education campaign and advocacy of changing both, you know, the ability for you to register, the dates, you know, absentee ballots. In Washington, I was shocked when I was like, what do you mean you can vote up to, whatever, 5 or 6 weeks in advance? We can't do that. And, you know, just that type of awareness of, what, this state does it one way, this state does it another way. It's, again, it's, if you depoliticize it, but it's problem solving and convenience and better technology, efficiency, these terms that are, again, how you frame it. It doesn't have that lightning rod of, you know, socialism or whatever it is. And that's where, you know, you can kind of test and try out these different ideas and come at it in different ways. So in terms of the nuclear arms race, these are young people have grown up from Homer Simpson on out. They're just sort of, oh, you know, it's kind of a joke. They see it as kind of, and they have very clearly seen, though, the devastation of conventional wars, with these ongoing wars. So they have a very different sense of what are the threats. So again, if you're presenting it in terms of they see the impacts on families that have served, all these different issues, okay, allocating resources and priorities and caring for service members or honoring, as opposed to these, you know, enormous weapon systems, there are different ways of kind of learning how to argue that help to tackle the problem that's not in that, you know, kind of everyone's sort of opposed to, or just have this allergy to politics. It's kind of a dirty word, but in fact, it's looking at public policy and public goods. So, yeah. So anyone else have, though, people? I want to hear people that have, yeah, that can provide models or lessons for us.
Well, I'm just saying also, if we each look at very daily decisions we make in our lives, things become habits that are the old way.
Yeah.
I remember protesting before the Afghan war started, standing on the freeway overpass, and we certainly didn't have any effect on foreign policy, but it was, you know, when you're watching all those cars go by, mm-hmm. and you think we're dependent on oil and it's bad for our world, and we can't wait for someone else to change it. Mm-hmm. You have to.
Well, and that's a different era of protest.
One thing I love about Holden is the food is so healthy and organized and moderate.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to a restaurant, it's a scandal what that food is.
Yeah.
So I often feel powerless as far as making a change, but I've gotten involved over the years with League of Women Voters, and we are within our community, and we're trying to reach out statewide and stay connected to find out what other leagues are doing so that maybe we can steal and give away and ideas of things we're working on. But getting into the high schools, and we go to every event that we can that they will accept us, set up a table, have our computers there so we can show them how to use MyVote and how easy it is to register and how easy it is to get information.
Right.
And it makes me feel like I'm doing something.
Right. And this is really, my daughter is very concerned about this. I grew up, my mom was with the League of Women Voters. I would go with her and sit on election day as she did it. But my daughter, she's very concerned about it. She's interested in what's called Rock the Vote and these other groups. So that it kind of has different names and different generations. But League of Women Voters, I'm at a public university at UMass Amherst, and I oversee students doing internships. They've done a tremendous job of having college students come and work with them and getting, you know, both doing educational outreach, and then they go back on our campus and work with the student governments, because there is this sense, college students are wonderfully in their own world. And then, you know, sort of this issue of, and as much as I just am so mad, it's like, you guys can go out of the campus and go vote, but it's working to put the voting booths on campus so that there's no excuse. So, you know, there are all these, so this is where, again, the adversity, that sense of overwhelmed, you find these baby steps, these little pieces that you can work with different groups and have allies, both with young people, with other organizations, and stuff that you love.
We've got one woman in our group who has been trying to find out just what do the high schools teach as far as civics is concerned.
It
sounds like it's just changed tremendously. So she has started calling on a state level.
Yeah.
To find out who she can connect with and how can we help you? What kind of information do you need?
And
a lot of high schools have eliminated civics.
Yes.
There isn't any. I mean, that's again, and then unfortunately, then they do the AP classes, which don't even, you know, provide. So I'm very strongly like, you're going to college to have a liberal arts education as well as whatever your major is. But that's again, there are a lot of, and that's, again, that's a privileged community. There's also wonderful expansion in community colleges and other opportunities.
What is AP?
Advanced placement.
Yes.
So in high school, you take a course and it can count as having already taken a college level course. So they'll take in high school what they call American government, and it's just kind of memorizing for the test, and it's not really what I would like to see is more critical thinking skills, debate, and being engaged with people from different parts of the country, different political beliefs, to talk about our system of government, the strengths, the weaknesses, and sort of being educated.
But not every student qualifies for AP.
Right.
So
but that's a question of resources and school. Yes. Yeah.
So we had a naturalization ceremony up here, and they put the questions on the table, and some of us couldn't answer those questions.
I know.
You know, and because we were born in this country, and that was very interesting.
Yeah.
And also how proud those people were. The other thing I didn't realize is how expensive it is for them to become citizens.
Yeah.
We knew your work for a minute.
So we have about 15 minutes, and so I want to just do a check-in, because I love this conversation, but what would people feel is most helpful in this time together? Would you like to go on and talk about specific stories of overcoming adversity and sustaining commitment, or
I was just gonna, would it be possible just to go around the room and name, everybody name a group, a listserv, a thing that you're members of or you know people are members of, because I think that's really important for us to keep our sanity, is to know that there are ways to get to work.
Yeah.
And that you know, these are little bites of the elephant.
Right. Behind you, yesterday we did this in terms of actions. No, this is different. This was just kind of what's on the agenda, what are some social actions, what are actions that we've heard in the press? And this was kind of our first piece. And then the idea is kind of expand it and flesh it out. It's not just what we've already heard of that's getting a lot of publicity. It's really building upon your core convictions, your strengths, and where you see we should be going. Going from your inspiration, what are actions that are meaningful, and moving out from there. But I think this is terrific. So how about I will just stand here if anyone wants to.
Well, I'll tag on to League of Women Voters. There's a group called Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And they won the Nobel Peace Prize about 100 years ago. And they're still going. And they have chapters in quite a few countries. And they tackle things like, they follow the UN like a hound dog and the debates that are going on nuclear weapons, cluster munitions, autonomous, killer robots are coming. They're coming rapidly. The rich countries are really happy to think they can go around killing people without losing any men of their own.
So I got to share Ray Atchison, who works for the Women's International League. It has been started from early 1900s and has been organized over the years from anti-World War I organizing on out. They won the Nobel Peace Prize. They were one of the members for this test ban treaty. And it's an extraordinary organization. It's the acronym is WILPF for freedom. And the thing that's so terrific right now is, so I feel like I'm in contact with Ray and others because I get both Twitter, I get email updates, you can go to their websites, you can listen in on their speeches and engagement. They're now planning for September at the UN, different actions. I get their email updates. And this is something that as you're exploring, you may not want to jump in, this may not be your group, but it's very easy to kind of get on the list, you can cancel it later, or just look and see and figure out whether or not this is an extraordinary group that's been at it for, they focus on a range of issues in peace and security. Yeah.
And the focus is the policy stream.
Right. So that's again, for our artists and our healthcare people and our scientists, they're very different communities and arenas where I would encourage you to get involved. Sometimes, at a certain stage of life, I just got so tired of this stuff and I was working on our public library. I was like, the library's open to everyone. I'm going to do that. I can do that. And I helped them do a five-year plan. They needed to reach out to the community in order to get state funding because they were so poor, they didn't have money. And I had this like local piece. And that just made me feel better. Like, okay, well, at least people can get information. It's a place that's inclusive of everyone in our community. They expanded services from career, job, this and that. So there are different ways, depending on what stage you are in life. So what are other groups? Yeah.
Partners in Health?
Yeah.
So that's the group.
Right, right.
The tall farmer founded.
Yeah.
Mountains Beyond Mountains went around the room. It's a inspirational book, and Partners in Health is a super inspirational organization, and they're all over the world now. They started in Haiti, but they're in Africa and South America, and everywhere there are people that are resource short and don't have access to good health care. So for anybody interested in health care issues and public health issues, that's a great organization to explore supporting.
They're incredible, and I just want to tell you, how many of you have Amazon accounts? How many of you do Amazon Smile? Amazon Smile, it's just on there. They will give a certain percentage of whatever you buy to an organization. I have it for Partners in Health. Wow. So I feel like every time you buy something, they will donate, I don't know what the percentage is.
0.5%
Yeah. But
it adds up.
And for me, that's my signaling to Amazon. This is a group that's doing something, you know, as I'm a consumer. But I just wanted to say that's another example. Partners in Health, and they are fabulous. There are other groups as well, which are in the field, training and working from issues of TB, HIV, all these different things there have tremendous impacts. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a small one, but they've been around for 100 years. As a Fellowship of Reconciliation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Their peace, and then secondarily, they've gotten a lot into social justice.
Yeah, they're wonderful. How many have heard of them? Yeah.
Primarily, you know, the movers behind them are the Friends of Quakers. Mm-hmm. Kind of the long-distance runners of the anti-war.
And what's interesting about them, they're less in the public eye because they are orienting towards, just as Jonathan's talking about, of supporting in the field. So they have less in terms of the number of people working here in the United States who are going abroad because they are doing it in a different way. So yeah, they're absolutely wonderful.
And they'll come with a large part, maybe even the majority of their training interns to go out and mm-hmm. work in the South or wherever.
Yeah, What are some other groups?
Indivisible.
Yes, Indivisible, yes.
So it's I think, started by some of Obama's members. And then there's little chapters of it everywhere. You know, within our area, there's a Chicago one, a Naperville one, a DuPage County. And so not only do they do national things and kind of unite you that way, so you can network that way, but then we had, you know, our local, we had our city council. We invited city council, the mayor. So, you know, so they came and they put on forums for them, but at the same time.
And I think
it's
not hard.
It's really.
Yeah. It's, I think they also put you. Didn't they have debate parties? So it's so funny. Like sometimes you just don't want to engage in politics, but if you're watching with other people and you can, somebody hosts a debate party, or if there's something going on, you can all join together, people in your community, and that's another way that you don't feel isolated.
Southern Poverty Law Center.
Right. Yeah. Right. Tell more about that.
They enjoy exposing some of the alt-right terrorists in this country. And that they help people, they're against hate groups, and they're helping protect people that are being targeted.
Right. So this domestic extremism, terrorism, all of this, they are on the front lines documenting, reporting, forcing police authorities, FBI, and out to kind of investigate it. They have been absolutely extraordinary.
ACLU,
yes. And ACLU has, it's an interesting thing because they actually have been getting a lot of attention and money, but what they're doing again is voter registration, voter suppression, and targeting in key states, going out and training and working with. And what's interesting is, again, who are the allies? It's not just, you know, once every 4 years, you find this also in terms of union organizations and different things in different parts of the country. So coming at these things. Okay, so it is official 8:30. And I just want to take a couple seconds to just really quickly wrap up. My hope in this is, first of all, I just am so inspired by this group of people on this beautiful day to come together and to be talking about these issues. And for me, I am hoping to continue. I will be here actually for 2 weeks. I'll be continuing next week. So I welcome
feedback, suggestions. There are postcards, these cards, if you want to say anything, for how to organize it, both these official sessions and then also, what's extraordinary here is we'll be able to do something at Vespers, I hope, next week as a part of Vespers, if you have any ideas of something that might be welcome. Of course, I would coordinate with the other people here at Holden. But I am hoping that this just gave you a little nibble of so many different opportunities and ways in which you can look upon your own experience, what has both inspired you, what you've learned, and then reaching out to other people, other organizations, and just exploring. And no guilt, no pressure, but there is a lot going on. And finding the key piece is finding something that is positive. I call it positive stress. You have to get out of your comfort zone. You're not just sitting. You have to kind of try something a little bit different, interacting with different people, perhaps putting, you know, calling up or contacting, emailing somebody in public office or in a position that, you know, you might not otherwise engage with, and then really trying to find that village, those teams, those stakeholders that will help you to kind of follow up on your concerns and how you can feel like you're positively contributing. So anyway, thank you so much.
Do you have a website?
Yes.
It
is. Oh, sorry. Yes. Let me give you my card. I'm at the University of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth Honors College.
Thank you.
So I have both one in the political science. I'm in the Department of Political Science. And I will be making available. They're doing a podcast, and I'll be making available some of these slides that if they want to put them. I don't know whether they will or not, but anyway. But I thank you all. It's really such a privilege, and I'm hoping to continue over meals.
Laura, could I just say one thing?
Yeah.
I was struck the first day how many people were really upset about the state of the world, and today as well. I think that the best medicine for that is to pick one of these areas and go for it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Do little things.
Yeah.
With other people.
Right.
Never alone.
Yeah.
Always with other people.
And that's the thing. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's like there are all these
changes
people that
the
went at it. And it's sometimes you just need to shake it up. Like you just want to do something. Like for me, you know, it's like, oh, many years ago I did X or Y. That had fallen by the wayside. And now, and I joke, and I also finally say, I tell my husband, you're in charge of the environment. Oh, I mean, it's fine for you to tell your friends, okay, you're in charge of that area. Keep me posted when it's really important and I have to do some alert. But, you know, you can't take it all on. Go with the things that you really feel like at this moment move you. So,
can I add one other thing?
Yeah.
One thing I think that's been really helpful to me is some smart person in our area started something called Courageous Conversations.
Mm.
And, of course, the emphasis is on diversity. But whoever wants to can come there. But it takes a facilitator who can keep things moving, who can encourage people. I remember one night there was a Muslim who came and he was talking openly, and then he said, "Oh, I can't go there." And the facilitator said, "Yes, you can. You need to here in this group." But yeah, I just heard so. You know, I go and I listen.
Do you need to like pass around? Or?
Anybody, I have cards. If anyone wants them, if anyone wants to see them. It's also, you can just look online. It's like, yeah. But thank you so much. And you're free. You're free. Enjoy the people here.